Hello there. Today is Thursday, March 12th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as nations continue to fight the novel coronavirus, the World Health Organization declares it a global pandemic.
Pandemic is not a word to use lightly.
This is the U.S. president seeks to calm the nation.
I am confident that by counting and continuing to take these tough measures, we will significantly reduce the threat to our citizens, and we will ultimately and expeditiously defeat this virus.
As president makes a power grab. Also ahead, it's more and more likely Joe Biden will be the person to take on Donald Trump in his bid for a second term. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, a basketball tournament with no fans, a St. Patrick's Day with no parades, college campuses with no students, corporate headquarters with barren cubicles. The U.S. snapped to attention Wednesday over the novel coronavirus as stocks slid and the American public finally came to grips with the reality of the coronavirus outbreak. President Donald Trump held a rare primetime address from the Oval Office to calm the public, saying all travel from Europe, excluding the UK, will be suspended for 30 days starting Friday at midnight.
There will be exemptions for Americans who have undergone appropriate screenings, and these prohibitions will not only apply to the tremendous amount of trade and cargo, but various other things as we get approval.
And in a reversal of his previous comments and tone and content, he said he will be putting a plan together to provide businesses and citizens with financial relief.
This will be targeted for workers who are ill, quarantined, or caring for others due to coronavirus. I will be asking Congress to take legislative action to extend this relief.
Also, Trump urging Americans to be vigilant. Earlier in the day, Democrats were highly critical of the president. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said the White House has failed in a number of ways since the crisis began.
We are just appalled that the administration really has had no plan. Here we are. It's close to 2 months since we first knew about coronavirus. They have all kinds of problems, obviously, with testing, but they also have not come up with a plan to help people who need help.
And in one of the hardest hit U.S. states, Washington Senator Patty Murray says the Trump administration was too slow in helping her own state.
You can be sure that I'm going to get to the bottom of this and make sure it never happens again. I am furious that instead of acting with urgency, they did nothing. Instead of acting with transparency, they kept quiet.
Health and government officials have been sounding the alarm about the virus for nearly 2 months as it infected and killed thousands of people, bouncing from China to Iran to Italy and beyond before striking Seattle, Washington in the first deadly outbreak in the U.S. But Wednesday seemed to be the day that the larger American public came to the dawning realization that the toll of the virus would be unavoidable for months to come, or perhaps longer. Meanwhile, the status of the worldwide COVID-19 coronavirus outbreak has officially changed.
We're deeply concerned both by the alarming levels of spread and severity and by the alarming levels of inaction. We have therefore made the assessment that COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic.
World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus made the announcement Wednesday and warned that the worst is likely yet to come. He says they do not take this label lightly.
It's a word that, if misused, can cause unreasonable fear or unjustified acceptance that the fight is over, leading to unnecessary suffering and death.
He said in the days and weeks ahead, the number of cases, deaths, and affected countries will climb even higher. That sentiment was shared in the United States by Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
We will see more cases, and things will get worse than they are right now.
Governments around the world are trying to take steps to address the ever-changing outbreak, which since December has infected more than 118,000 people and killed about 4,300 in 114 countries. Joining us to discuss the latest on how this virus is operating is Dr. Lloyd Minor, Dean of the Stanford University Medical School, or School of Medicine. What do we know and what do we not know?
We know that it's in the same family as the SARS virus and the MERS virus. It seems to be transmitted by droplets, so the viral particles are embedded in saliva or mucus. So the key to preventing the infection is not to have contact with saliva or mucus that's infected with the virus. That means frequent hand washing, 20 seconds with soap and water, or alcohol-based hand sanitizers when soap and water are not available. It means if you do cough, cover your cough. It appears to be more transmissible than seasonal flu, and it also appears to be more dangerous than seasonal flu. If we look at the mortality rate of people with COVID-19 infection, now granted, a lot of this data comes from parts of the world that don't have access to the type of advanced medical treatment that we have here in the United States.
It's interesting because one of the warnings is to do not shake hands with or, you know, get too close in contact with someone who may have the virus, and yet we don't know how many people, potentially thousands, could be walking around with it and not know it.
True. We don't know. I mean, we do know that some people have very mild infections. We hypothesize that some people may not even know that they have a COVID-19 infection, although that's difficult to prove at the current time because our ability to test for the virus is only now getting scaled up. And finally, we certainly know that some people have a very serious form of COVID-19 infection, and that some proportion of those people with a very serious infection die as a result of the infection. And it's that uncertainty about who's going to become infected, you know, what distinguishes a person who has a very mild infection from someone who has a very severe infection. We know, and that we saw from what happened in Seattle, that people who have medical problems to begin with are more likely to have serious illness from a COVID-19 infection because their health is not as good at baseline when who doesn't have the health problems. But there's still a lot of uncertainty about the transmission of the virus, the reasons why some people have mild infection, other people have a much more serious infection. Those are things that are still being worked out.
Can it be spread airborne?
It appears to be spread by droplets. You know, the CDC is updating information about the virus in real time. The CDC recommendations up to this time have been to have airborne isolation for people who are actively infected and in a hospital care environment. As to whether or not those recommendations might change in the future to be droplet precautions rather than airborne precautions, that's something I think all of us are watching very carefully.
Is the level of concern that we're seeing around the world with such a highly infectious virus that seems to be continuing to spread, how much worse do you think this could get given what we're seeing?
It's hard to know. I think it's going to take another couple of weeks to know. I think the public health measures that are being taken in the United States today are prudent. They represent, in my view, the right kind of response to the challenge that COVID-19 presents. I also believe that we're going to see in a reasonably short period of time an increase in our testing capacity for the virus, and that will help identify patients earlier who are infected and then to have them self-quarantine or not be around others where the virus can be transmitted.
All right, that's Dr. Lloyd Minor, Dean of the Stanford University School of Medicine. Tom Hanks and his actress wife, Rita Wilson, have tested positive for the coronavirus, the actor said in a statement. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn has more.
They're in isolation. 63-year-old Tom Hanks announces he and his wife, Rita Wilson, will continue to be tested, observed, and isolated as long as needed. He says they were in Australia and noticed they felt tired. They had colds, fever, and body aches. So given the current situation, Hank says they were tested and were positive for the new coronavirus. He says they're just taking a one-day-at-a-time approach and signed off on social media urging others to take care of themselves. The virus is more dangerous for the elderly and those with chronic illness. The vast majority of patients recover. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Well, meanwhile, the virus has also caused the NBA to go on hiatus. Correspondent Denny Kapp has that story.
The NBA has suspended its season until further notice after calling off Wednesday night's Thunder Jazz game just before tip-off. A person with knowledge of the situation has told the Associated Press that Jazz All-Star center Rudy Gobert tested positive for the coronavirus. The NBA says the test result was reported shortly before the start of the game, and players were told to return to their locker rooms. About 30 minutes later, fans were told the game had been postponed due to unforeseen circumstances. I'm Denny Kapp.
Well, for most people, the new coronavirus causes only mild or moderate symptoms such as fever and cough. For some, especially older adults and people with existing health problems, it can cause more severe illness, including pneumonia. According to the World Health Organization, people with mild illness recover in about 2 weeks, while those with more severe illness may take 3 to 6 weeks to recover. Well, fears are growing that disruptions from the pandemic will strangle U.S. economic growth and send the country into recession, a period of economic contraction. VOA's Brian Padden reports that the White House is considering a range of short-term measures to ease financial strain on affected businesses and workers, but economists warn the more the virus spreads, the greater the economic impact and the longer it may take to recover.
In the United States, there is increasing concern over the economic disruptions caused by the coronavirus, now classified as a pandemic.
We would expect that this is going to potentially be a weak economic period for the United States. We will not see the growth that we had projected.
The travel industry has already been devastated by coronavirus outbreaks on cruise ships and by widespread air travel cancellations. Advisories against public gatherings have prompted the cancellation of conferences, music festivals, and sporting events, and has left restaurants and theaters struggling to survive. Partial closure of factories in China that make automobile parts are raising concerns that American car makers will have to cut production. Financial markets have reacted with fear and extreme volatility, with stock values and oil prices plummeting. President Trump has downplayed the risk the coronavirus poses to Americans' health and their finances.
Well, this was unexpected. It will go away. Just stay calm. It will go away.
The president has floated the idea of temporary tax cuts for affected industries and workers. The White House is also considering paid family leave for workers, but it is unclear how it would be implemented.
Usually in the business world, this is something that business people would become very, very concerned about and typically not like. But I think right now we're facing a public health crisis.
Passing new spending measures will require support from Democrats in Congress, who want extra funding for medical testing and care, expanded unemployment insurance, and increased spending on social safety net programs.
It will add to the federal deficit in the short term, but that's important if it means protecting the safety and security of the American public and restoring the economic confidence needed to go forward.
Decisive measures are needed soon, say analysts, to provide immediate relief to those affected and to hasten an economic recovery after the outbreak ends. Brian Padden, VOA News, Washington.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders vowed Wednesday to stay in the Democratic primary race for president despite Joe Biden's big wins in Michigan and three other states Tuesday. The two men will meet in another Democratic debate Sunday before competing in more primaries next Tuesday. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on the state of the Democratic race from Washington.
Senator Bernie Sanders told reporters in his home state of Vermont that he is staying in the race to push a progressive agenda favored by younger voters.
While Joe Biden continues to do very well with older Americans, especially those people over 65, our campaign continues to win the vast majority of the votes of younger people.
The Sanders announcement came on the heels of four more Biden victories Tuesday, including the key battleground state of Michigan.
But I believe we're in the battle for the soul of this nation. With Donald Trump as president, our core values, our standing in the world, our very democracy, everything that has made America, America, is truly at stake.
The former vice president also began the process of reaching out to Sanders supporters.
And I want to thank Bernie Sanders and his supporters for their tireless energy and their passion. We share a common goal, and together, we'll defeat Donald Trump. We'll defeat him together.
Biden continues to benefit from strong support from African American voters and Democrats focused on defeating President Donald Trump in November, like Deb Arnold.
I voted for Joe Biden because I think he has the best chance of uniting Democrats and moderate Republicans and independents in getting Donald Trump out of office.
Given Biden's latest success in Michigan and the other primaries on Tuesday, it is now his race to lose, says expert Elaine Kmark.
So Joe Biden seems to have the momentum now, and I think Bernie Sanders is going to stay in for a while and try to collect some delegates and try to change the party in the direction he thinks it should be changed in. And we could have a race all the way to the convention, or we could have a race that ends in a couple of weeks. At this point, we just don't know.
Biden's victories in recent weeks show he has convinced many voters that he would be the strongest opponent for President Trump, says analyst Laura Brown.
The idea that Democrats would fight all the way through June and all the way into the convention sort of misses what is motivating voters most right now. They want to find a nominee, find one that is electable, and find a way to best Donald Trump.
Given Biden's widening lead and the delegate count, Sanders is running out of time to stop him, says Thomas Schwartz.
Everything has really come together very strongly for Joe Biden now. Now he needs to continue his string of electoral victories, but he's really in a situation where Bernie Sanders' campaign is in crisis mode. They're going to have to stop his momentum at some point.
Biden and Sanders square off in another debate on Sunday and then compete in several large state primaries next Tuesday, including Florida, Illinois, Ohio, and Arizona. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
In other world news, we're following at VOA. After a series of delays, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani issues a decree promising to release 1,500 Taliban prisoners as a goodwill gesture to get intra-Afghan negotiations started. Russian lawmakers rapidly rubber-stamping sweeping constitutional changes that could keep Russian President Vladimir Putin in power until 2036. If Putin won and completed two more terms as president, it would make him the ruler of Russia for 36 years, longer than any other leader in its modern history. And former movie mogul Harvey Weinstein was sentenced to 23 years in prison Wednesday, pleading for mercies, as his accusers say his punishment in the landmark Me Too rape case is long overdue, after two of his accusers confronted him again in court. The 67-year-old broke his courtroom silence to say he feels remorse for the situation. Find more stories at voanews.com. Just ahead on International Edition.
The traditional story that we all remember of suffrage, and that's the story we were taught of Susan B. Anthony leading a gallant band of women on a long struggle for the vote.
Well, the UN Security Council urged governments Wednesday to take a holistic approach to combating the evolving threat from terrorism and violent extremism in Africa. VOA United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir has more.
Al-Shabaab, Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram. Some are homegrown. Others, like ISIL, have been driven out of Syria and Iraq and are finding their way to Africa in search of havens and recruits. Fragile states with porous borders are especially vulnerable, particularly those in the so-called Arc of Instability, which stretches across the Sahara and Sahel. Tunisia's UN envoy, Tarek Ladeb, pointed to the war in Libya as one of the driving forces of regional violence.
The ongoing war in Libya, always fueled by foreign players who keep sending weapons and fighters, is feeding this terrorist dynamics on the continent and continue to reinforce terrorist groups and to affect the situation in Africa, especially in the Sahel region.
And it's not just disaffected and unemployed men who are being radicalized and recruited. Women are too. In some instances, women have been recruited as suicide bombers. UN Political Chief Rosemary DiCarlo told council members that countries cannot effectively address terrorism without dealing with its root causes.
The threat of terrorism is often a consequence of development, humanitarian, human rights, and security challenges that terrorist groups seek to exploit. Security and military solutions are thus not sufficient.
Too often, governments respond to extremism rather than acting early to prevent it. The UN says that for each dollar invested in prevention, the cost of conflict is reduced by more than $16 in the long term. U.S. Ambassador Kelly Kraft said Washington is engaged with partners across Africa to train military and police forces, strengthen criminal justice systems, and cut the flow of funds to terrorists.
The United States is working to build the capacity of our African partners to prevent, detect, deter, disrupt, and prosecute terrorists across the continent. The bottom line here is that terrorism can be beaten. This is a fight governments and citizens can win.
The Security Council stressed the need to continue and improve support to African states at the national, sub-regional, and regional levels, including through specialized capacity building, training, sharing of best practices, and facilitating socioeconomic development. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
You're listening to International Edition.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues.
It's about listening to them
and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, the year 2020 marks the 100th anniversary of the U.S. Constitution's 19th Amendment granting women the right to vote. Museums in the Washington, D.C. area are celebrating the exhibitions that tell the story of how women fought to vote, for the right to vote. Maxim Moskalkov has more from the National Museum of American History.
American women fighting for the right to vote called themselves suffragettes, from the word suffrage, which means to vote. They painted signs, chained themselves to rails, attacked policemen with umbrellas, and stormed stores and government offices, organized rallies and demonstrations, all part of their fight.
Now, this exhibit looks at the way, the traditional story that we all remember of suffrage, and that's the story we were taught of Susan B. Anthony leading a gallant band of women on a long struggle for the vote. And that's a wonderful story, and it's not that it's not true, but it leaves out so many people.
These women who fought side by side and have made gains since then are the center of the exhibit at the National Museum of American History. Their personal belongings, hand-painted banners, badges, portraits and documents, even the wooden hammer of Nancy Pelosi, the first female speaker of the United States House of Representatives, all these items are part of the exhibit and part of the long battle women waged and still wage in their fight to civil and political rights.
So in this exhibit, we wanted to juxtapose the story of the people we know and wonderful icons that the museum has in their collection about those people, and to juxtapose them with the people that we're less familiar with, people like Mabel Lee, a young Chinese American woman who fought for suffrage in New York City, although she herself, because Chinese Americans were not considered citizens, would not benefit from the vote when the amendment was passed.
The 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that granted women the right to vote was adopted in 1919, even though it was first proposed in 1878. Thanks to women who fought for voting rights, Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton among them, the amendment was finally ratified on August 18, 1920.
So we've juxtaposed suffrage with 1977, and the National Women's Conference in 1977, held in Houston, Texas, where women met together and came up with a legislative agenda that they sent to the President and Congress to enact for women's rights, and the 2017 Women's March, which was seen as a revitalization of the women's movement. And in both of those modern movements, the activists hearken back to the suffragists as inspiration and as role models.
The 2017 Women's March took place in multiple cities across the U.S. after the inauguration of President Donald Trump. Over 5 million people took part in the march, making it the largest single-day protest in the American history.
In the Women's March in 2017, we actually saw women carrying posters, or the sash that you see in this exhibit, where they actually were echoing the suffrage movement. The 1848 to 2017 sash starts with Seneca Falls, which was the first time that women's suffrage was publicly advocated by women in this country.
Women have claimed their power and reclaimed the story and taken the narrative back from the prevailing narrative. One of the ways that that happened in 2017 was with the pussy hat that you can see on exhibit in this exhibit. It was an attempt to reclaim a word that was sometimes derogatory and make it something that would be celebrated and powerful.
The exhibit at the National Museum of American History has more than 60 objects on display, some of which were gifted to the Smithsonian by the National Women's Suffrage Association back in the 1920s. Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Washington.
Well, Kenya's Amboseli National Park is home to herds of elephants, which are prone to poaching for the illicit trade of ivory. But now a program that has brought on board women in the fight against poachers is gaining traction. Lenny Ruvaga reports.
23-year-old Purity Amleset goes through the paces with her team. Today, Amleset is the team lead in this all-female unit, ensuring that all rangers have their orders correct. The task, locating an elephant and her newborn calf. Dubbed Team Lioness, the ranger unit is comprised of 8 women whose core duties involve protecting wildlife within the Olgululuwi Ololorashi Group Ranch, which covers around 1,230 square kilometers. Amleset says joining an all-female ranger unit has been beneficial to the traditionally patriarchal Maasai community.
Our community held the view that women and girls were the weaker sex, and that girls could only do menial jobs and housework, which included only raising a family. But over the course of time, we have been showing and telling them the importance of being a ranger.
Olgululuwi Ololorashi Group Ranch surrounds Amboseli National Park, making it a likely gateway for poachers who may seek entry into the park to hunt illegally. Patrick Papatiti, the commander of the Olgululuwi Community Wildlife Rangers, has around 76 rangers under his charge. He says integrating women hasn't been easy.
We have the same mentality, even within the ranger unit, where men ranger unit. The same mentality that they, ladies, cannot do it. But surprisingly, we have the best young women who can run, who can walk faster than these guys, who can go long distances than these guys. So from that working together, they worked for themselves and they earned the respect they have with them among the team of the other men.
Despite the challenges, in the end, James Isiche, the regional director for East Africa from the International Fund for Animal Welfare, says starting an all-female ranger unit was a risk worth taking.
Most of societies in Kenya, or communities in Kenya, are male-dominated, but this particular one is extremely male-dominated. So getting young ladies to engage in what is seen as a man's job is a huge success. And what we are seeing is that it's encouraging other girls to step up.
Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Kajiado, Kenya.
This is International Edition. I'm Lori London. Thank you so much for joining us. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Calvin Fowler, have yourself a wonderful day, and thank you for listening.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.